This is Meredith for Real, the Curious Introvert, and I'm Meredith. Here we explore the taboo, less obvious, and paradoxical aspects of society. Questions that you think but don't ask. Questions that need nuanced answers, not just Google results. These are the conversations you thought you would never get to have. And the goal? To inspire curiosity over judgment. Each episode is different, so bring your ADD and your earbuds and have a look around. This week is Remastered from 2020, a fan favorite where my guest shares how he went from being a felon doing a decade in prison to being a million-dollar business owner. He didn't just do any decade in prison either. His time was from the early 2000s to 2012. So think about that. That's flip phones and people writing checks for groceries to Facebook and Google in your pocket. It was so interesting to hear not just the details of prison, but also his mindset, which is a huge ingredient, I believe, in setting himself up for success on the outside. And I also loved hearing how he managed to not just get a job after, but also how he launched his own business. This was his first time ever telling his story, and he's my cousin, so this episode has a special place in my heart. If you end up liking this one, you'll also like the one I did with a man that Jason met while in prison. And that one is about how he accidentally killed two girls in a DUI accident. It's called Eagle Scout to Inmate, and it's episode 37. Lastly, if you like giving your opinion and getting free stuff, you're officially invited to join my private Facebook group. Click the link in the episode description to request to join. All right, friends, keep it curious. If you bought ecstasy in the 90s in Pensacola, chances are good you got it from our next guest. His lifestyle got him in and out of jail a dozen times before eventually going to prison for 11 years for burglary with aggravated battery, great bodily harm. After being a statistic, he became determined to break the mold and now runs a million-dollar company and navigates the challenges of raising happy, healthy boys. Today, he's going to tell his story of what led to prison, the types of people you find there, and the mindsets that can pull you in and lift you out. Prisoner no more. ADHD success story. My cousin, in law and in love, Jason Edwards, everyone. Ta-da! You made it.
I did.
So take me back to when you first got arrested. Kind of what was your mindset, outlook? What was going on back then?
It was a long road from a broken family, father out of the picture, you know. It rapidly got worse as, I got older and then turned into an adult and then drugs came into it. And then I saw I could make money this way. Mm-hmm. And then I was wrapped up in all of that. It was attractive, right? It was a easy way to make money. And
yeah. Is it one of those things like once you kind of get wrapped into it, it's hard to just go, you know what, guys, I'm good. Never mind.
It is. I usually take whatever I'm doing and I take ownership of it. So, you know, back then there was a lot of people that depended on me. I know this sounds weird, but you know, there were people that depended on me to help them make rent or help them make money or feed the, and this is a terrible story, but feed the addictions, you know, and I was the person. So it became like the center point of a lot of people. And then at some point, naturally with drugs, they tear you apart, they rip you up, and they spit you out, and they don't care, right? So it started getting rough. It was easy at the beginning. You know, I'm this social butterfly. I'm happy. I'm always got jokes. I'm a comedian, right? And, you know, at the beach, surfing, whatever, party, whoo, you know. And then it started getting serious. Like, this is a lot of money here, and people started taking angles at me, and then I didn't trust anybody, and then there was these pockets of enemies, you know, like it was real. It was intense. And
quantify a lot of money because people don't know.
It was about 1,000 pills of X a week, anywhere from $25,000 a week to 30. It just depended. I mean, it depends on
25,000 a week.
It was a lot. It was a lot of money moving through Pensacola at that time. Yeah.
Well, no wonder it got serious real fast.
It got, yeah. And so I go from this, you know, just, hey, let's just hang out and have a good time to like, you know, protecting and scared and defensive. And there were people that came with me just as like help, like just to have, not protection, but it was protection. I mean, there were people out there that that at some point thought that they could take from me what they thought was easy, I guess. Yeah. And then that's when the charges ended up. So, you know, there was a lot of stupid, silly stuff along the way, you know, driving with a suspended license here or there, or random small charges that just kind of kept me on the path of building the resume for ultimately my demise. And then one day they finally took it. So they took it. They attempted to take it. And at this point, you got the whole underground town of Pensacola looking at me going, how are you going to react to this? You know, and like I was, it was like I had to act as aggressive and a bully. And I had to, it was this persona that I had built up to, you know, just represent in a way that kept me safe, I guess is the best way to put it. Unfortunately, I didn't know at the time, and no, you know, ignorance is no excuse to the law. I learned real quick is that that charge is one of seven in Florida punishable by life charges. So at the end of all that, this happens. We fight. Somebody gets hurt. You know, I'm kind of rapidly firing through this pretty intense moment of my life, and investigators are coming, and I'm like, whoa, I don't know what's going on here. Like all this stuff's coming at me, and I was at the bottom of the barrel here, right? I was the worst of the worst in Pensacola at the time. You know, I had no morals. I had no integrity. I didn't have anything. It was every day, get up and do your thing. And then now these investigators are coming and they're asking me these questions. And I'm like trying to paint this picture of the preacher's grandson and, you know, like, oh, I'm okay. It's cool. You know? And they saw right through it. And so yeah, they charged me with aggravated battery, great bodily harm, burglary of battery. And as I started fighting my case and spending tons of money on attorneys and stuff, I realized I'd made a mistake that I cannot come back from now. And it's just, pay the piper. And
so that's when you started realizing like prison might be happening.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There was no question about it. It was 30 years on the table, like right off the bat. Or first they were like, you know, this is a punishable by life charge. And I was like, no, I didn't. We just got in a fight. I was just trying to downplay this thing. And we did. We really did get in a fight, you know, without going into all the specifics of the story. They started a fight with me. I responded. And then here we are. And I'm the bad guy, you know, mm-hmm. and I was. So it was really easy for me to accept kind of how the everything transpired, because when my mind was clear and the world around me wasn't coming at me at all angles really fast. And it was easy for me to kind of see. I mean, I was raised right. You know, I mean, my grandparents and my mom, mm-hmm. and there was deep rooted stuff that says, hey, you're a good guy. You know, I just lost my way.
Giving yourself excuses. You're saying like, hey, I should have known better. And
I should have known.
I got wrapped up. And
right.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, even through the case, I didn't really fight it and say not guilty. I'm saying, hey, I did this. These are the things that I want to do, not to do it again, and have mercy on me pretty much. You know, and the judge, I think, I mean, most people wouldn't agree to it, but I think that she was lenient, but I was staring down 30 years and they weren't coming off 30 years for about 8 months. It scared the crap. Anyway. But,
absolutely.
So
when you got to prison, tell me about the people that you met there and the types that, well, explain the difference between jail and prison, because I didn't know until kind of recently, and I don't think most people know.
Right. So county jail is where you go waiting to go to prison, or if you've done something that doesn't deem a state crime that, you know, that you'll do county time. So there's two different ways to do time. I've been through both of them quite extensively. I have an opinion that, you know, it should be prison over county. And the reasons are in county jail, everybody's waiting on a charge. Mm-hmm. They're waiting on the judge. Their family members are screaming at them. Their girlfriends or wives are like going, what the heck, you know? And so there's a lot of stress. The high energy in there is a lot of stress. It's really, really stressful. And so there's a lot of anger going on there. There's a lot of people coming off drugs or alcohol, and that's frustrating. Then they want to fight. So there's just this.
Because you're all together.
Yeah, it's all community based. I mean, you've got, you know, two levels. Two beds per level and 12, so 24, I don't know.
And then 36. In prison, you have like a room.
It depends on your custody. So in prison, you have either cells if you're like a high risk mm-hmm. of escape. So a person in life sentence is not going to be in an open bay dorm, right? Or if you are, you have like a past of aggression, you know, like you're just an angry person. You've fought with the prison guards, or you do a lot of fighting with prisoners.
Yeah.
So if you're doing all that, then they want to lock you up at night as to not, you know, keep you a close key, but
in your kennel.
Right. Yeah. And with my charges, that's where I started. So let me back up for a second. So they give me the sentence. I'm sitting in county jail and I'm waiting for prison. Right now, I have just gone through a labyrinth of nightmares, you know, that was a long time. At 17 months, I want to say that I stayed in county jail fighting the charges and, you know, not necessarily fighting them, but just going through the motions. There was no fighting. I did it, you know? So I'm sitting in there and now my mind's is to the next stage. Like, okay, what's next? What's going on? Where am I going? How do I get through this? Got all these years ahead of me, you know, over a decade. And like, how do I get through this? And I remember the first thing that I remember about going to prison was they wake you up in the middle of the night. You don't know that you're going and you're not supposed to know you're going, right? Because they don't want the bus to get overturned by somebody. So your name comes up on a list like a lottery ticket. They wake you up at like 2 a.m. They tell you to wrap all your stuff up. They put you in a knapsack and you go down into a tank and there's no communication with anybody except the people in the tank. So I'm down there. I'm a nervous wreck because here it is, right? I'm doing the Green Mile Walk, right? And I'm a nervous wreck and I've got all these questions. I'm like, I'm a talker. So like when I want to figure something out, I want everybody's brains to tell me what's going on. And so I'm a talker. I'm asking all these questions with these guys. And this old school guy comes up to me and he sits down. He's like, boy, he's like, you're too young. And I was like 21, I think at the time. He's like, man, you're too young to be doing this, you know? And I was like, man, I'm a nervous wreck. And he was like, look, it's going to be simple. This is all you got to do. He says, stay away from the homosexuals in prison, stay away from the drugs in prison, and stay away from the gambling. If you stay away from those three things right there, you're going to make it through your time. You do have a release date, right? And I was like, I do. He's like, do those three, follow those three rules. Man, I wrote them down every day. It was my mantra, you know? So for the first year, I'm just kind of, you know, in prison doing those things. I remember getting off the bus and got my knapsack over me, which is all your, you know, underwear, socks, letters, pencils, paper, you know? And I remember like walking down the line and they're telling the inmates, hey, you're going to this dorm, you're going to this dorm, you're going to this dorm. And I was like the only one that had like a punishable by life charge. So my custody level was really, really high coming off the bus. And so I'm the only one going down there to this T building, they called it. And as I'm going, I'm just like, I felt really on the street selling drugs, running the streets, having my friends, who all that. Man, I felt really, really big right at this moment. That big, you know, and so I'm just trying to keep my eyes forward and I'm just like, man, this is day one of a decade. Like, holy, you know?
Yeah.
So everything, first jail cell, first cellmate was a murderer of his child. Like there was like so many things that I had to like instantly become okay with. Right. So what do you do here? I don't approve of this. I don't really want to be around this person. I'm really not really wanting to go to sleep tonight when they lock these doors, you know, but you got to maintain your presence. You got to keep your chest up. You got to be strong. You know,
your body language has to be
specific. Right. And all the while in my head, I'm going, oh, my God. What am I doing?
Right.
You know, but
I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry. Yeah.
Uncle, no, we'll do it again.
So are you bunked with this person?
I was.
So it's like bunk beds.
Yep. Well,
So baby killers like right above or below you.
Below me, yes. And then come to find out as I met all these people, man, it's a whole new world in there. I mean, it's a whole world. Like everybody you can think of. I mean, everybody. I mean, I was, and I'm getting ahead of myself here, but I'm going through 10 years of experience. I'm just throwing ideas.
No, it's good.
So I was bunked with Fast Freddy Yoakum, which was one of the top three notorious jewel thieves in America. He used to work for the mob. So he comes in, he's just this old man. He's been in prison like 60 years. I have no idea who he is. Didn't even know he had a story, but he's dying from cancer they've been fighting the good fight. And he comes in and he's like, you know, my name's Fast Freddy Yoakum. Or no, he says, my Freddy Yoakum. And he had these guys coming in. So, you know, there's rules in prison. So when you get new roommates, you're not an outwardly friendly, sociable person in prison.
You're not shaking hands and
it takes a while.
Doing name tags.
Yeah, you're observing. You're kind of judging people's character. You're looking to see if they're shysty. There's all sorts of things that you're looking for in there. So, you know, there was even a rule that, you know, the first 10 people that approach you into a new dorm are the ones that you don't want to talk to. They've got some motive, you know.
How did you figure that out, though? Like, obviously, there's no handbook.
Watching and learning and mistakes. I mean, I couldn't tell you how many fights that I had been in there when, you know, like there was sometimes there's just evil people. They don't care, you know?
Did you meet anyone there that, like, you felt like could be me or you? Just, you know, like someone who was in the wrong place at the wrong time? And
absolutely. That's where the observations come in. So you meet a lot of really cool people in there, you know, good people, not cool, but good people that have all made the mistake. I mean, there's a lot of people in there that are committed to trying to do better, trying to figure out the problem at hand when you're in prison is what got me here and how do I prevent this again, right? Mm-hmm. If you're someone that wants to repair,
right,
you know, your life and not do this again. And there's pockets of people in there everywhere. So you got your gang members, you got people that like to read, people like to do sports, people that like to write, you know, so there's all sorts of things that they're interested in. And then those are the pockets that you circle around. And inside those pockets, there's little pockets of people that get along better. And so when you start to see that you're getting along with somebody or you're really liking where they're at and their personal growth, then y'all, you know, you click up and you start doing time together and bouncing ideas off each other. I've probably got a little piece of my success is probably broken down into 3 or 4 people in there where I've just really enjoyed their perspective and said, nope, I'm going to adopt that. And you've met one of them, Roger Jump. And he was probably the most instrumental role there. And he taught me what integrity meant and like how to walk and just, you know, a man of your word, you know? And
I think that would surprise a lot of people. Like what you're saying about, first of all, that you even had control about who you could hang out with, but that has a little bit to do with the security level of the prison that you're at.
Right.
And second of all, that there would be people in there who would be inspiring because, I mean, as you know, there's people out there that really just think like, I mean, I have heard some of my family members say this, like, well, you're in prison, so you shouldn't have TV. You shouldn't have college books. You know, this is not fun time. This is punishment time.
Yep. I mean, you're right. There's all sorts of perspectives here. So the judge even told me, I told her, you know, man, I've been this much time in prison or in jail. I've been incarcerated. I've tried to rehabilitate myself. And I don't think that rehabilitating myself is going to do good in prison. Now I changed that now. I absolutely had to go to prison to learn to be where I'm at today. I had to go through. There was nothing else that was going to stop this train from going down that road, you know?
And so how did you get a new perspective while you were in prison? Because you had a certain mindset going into prison, right? Then you had it totally shake up when you were doing the walk.
Right.
And then when you're in prison, obviously you could just go down a really dark path of hopelessness and despair, and there's obviously things you can get caught up with in prison. How did you stay out of that? Like mentally, you know?
I read thousands and thousands of books. Like seriously, even my wife was amazed when she started talking about these books and just didn't think of how much reading that I did. She's like, man, you're really well read. And I'm like, yeah, I didn't have anything to do for a decade, you know? But yeah. Like you said, what do I want to do with my time? How do I want to spend my time in here? And I wanted to spend it growing. I wanted to grow, like physically, spiritually, mentally. I wanted to grow. I just wanted to be a better person. I wanted to make better choices quicker. Mm-hmm. Like I do make good choices. Even in my bad moments, I do make them. It just takes me a really long time to get there. I just need to be able to make those faster. That's what I did. For 10 years, I stayed in school, vocational trades, read books, self-help books. And my family, so you can see this goodness happen in your family member in prison. You know, my family would come and visit me and they would see this inspiration or, you know, something's inspiring me. I have this glow about me. I'm really excited about certain topics, you know, of learning, of painting cars. I could go, you would laugh at all the ideas that I had, but I had all these ideas. And as this idea came, I would write my family and say, hey, could you send me a book on painting cars? Could you send me a book on how to run a sports bar? Because I was big into football and I had all these ideas of what would be a really cool football, cool spot, you know? And there was all sorts of things. Cleaning boats, leasing cameras. I mean, I could just go on and on, all these ideas. And my family would see these things and they would be like, yep, nope, I can send you a book. And why? Because that's good food for thought.
Right.
He didn't ask me for anything that was like a negative in his... It was a growth, you know, and so they supported me every time. And when I asked them for stuff that they didn't want me to digest, you know, they told me, no, I'm not going to buy these books. I wanted to get in like metaphysical religion. Like I wanted to get on the metaphysics of it. And so I was asking my mom, hey, I want you to buy me this metaphysical dictionary. Mm-hmm. And she's like, nope,
Aunt Lydia ain't doing that.
Ain't doing that. So I'm like, please. I mean, you know, anyway, so that's what I did. I educated myself. I just stayed in there, stayed focused. I wanted to make sure because I already knew. I knew it when I was getting out that the charges that I had were going to be a tick on me. I mean, like, I'm coming out and I'm going to say, hey, I'm this shining, awesome person. Please give me a chance. And they're like looking at your record going, no, you're a terrible person. So I wanted to allot myself every opportunity I could when I got out to say, hey, no, I do know about this. I can do that. I didn't want to have someone that wanted to give me a shot, not give me a shot because of my experience. So like, I knew computers were going to be a big thing. They weren't that big when I went in, but I knew they were going to be a big thing. So I got into classes that had computers so I could learn computers. I took PC support, you know, how to learn software and build a computer and, you know, all the software applications like that.
Do you feel like you would have done as well out of prison if you hadn't had those programs in prison?
Nope. No. I would have never stopped. There wasn't anything out here that could stop me and say, hey, you need to learn something, or you need to change your perspective about life, or you need to treat people better. Or, you know, there are people in this town now still that have that drug addiction. And there are people in there that I feel responsible for. Like, I can remember when that little epidemic of ecstasy hit Pensacola back then. And, mm-hmm. and I hold those things responsible, you know? I mean, I hold myself accountable for that. And I don't know. I'm losing my thought there with,
it's okay.
with the, you know, the repercussions of it. It just didn't destroy my life. It destroyed everybody that was associated with me back then, you know? Even my brother, you know, lucky for me, I think he really did learn his lessons. And I'm not going to say he learned them all from me, but I can tell you that my little road mm-hmm. to prison really scared him. You know, he still bumped his head a couple of times. He had to learn his own lessons, but he came out the other end a lot better position, you know.
I think what a lot of people don't realize is we're really all just one or two bad decisions away from going to jail and possibly also going to prison.
Yeah.
You know, you told me about that guy that had that DUI. He was like on leave or something, the military guy, mm-hmm. and he had no prior.
Nope. He had no priors. He was a good guy, and he's still a huge, huge advocate right now in the world. I mean, you can see him on TV. He does big speeches around America about, you know, drunk driving and what it can do for people. I mean, so here's how that goes down. He has a beer. He is over the illegal. He's over a legal limit, right? But he wasn't driving crazy. He was in functional. You know, he had good faculties about himself going home, and someone else lost control of their car, hit the other car. The other car hit him. That car runs off. These girls died that ran into him. But because he had alcohol, he goes to prison. DUI, yep. Driving under the influence, and yep. It cost their life, you know. And it's like, man, you're just driving down the road, minding your own business. Yep, I had a couple beers for lunch with my buddies or what, you know, whatnot. Yeah. And next day you're in jail and fighting for your life. And he had like 30 years, 40 years on that?
Yeah, I think it was, I read at least 30, I think.
Which is a lot of time. Now, he beat it. He came back. The family of the, you know, daughters saw that they're, you know, as they kind of got through their grief and probably looked at it as a whole, they realized that it really wasn't his fault.
Well, they asked him to go on tour
yep.
with the family to do talks in schools, I think.
Oh, You read the article.
I do my research, please.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, so prison's full of people that, you know, like yourself, that you were going down a wrong path and you really did, you deserve to be in prison. And then it's, I mean, I guess everyone, you could say, deserved being in prison. But I guess what I'm saying is there's those people, unfortunately, that are just never going to rehabilitate. And, you know, they're just always going to be down that path. But there's a lot of people in prison that are not like that as well. And we on the outside aren't all that different from those folks on the inside. So if you were going to like say something to like a young person or even just like a young adult going down this path that you were when you were in and out of jail for stupid stuff before you had the major arrest, what would you say to them?
So are we talking about the people that are being knuckleheads?
Yes. Dear knucklehead.
Well, and the funny thing is, I don't know that there's a way to stop it prematurely. You know, like I had to go through what I went through to get where I'm at. You know, I mean, it was just an experience that I had to take. You know, when you originally brought this kind of to me and I was interested in it, you know, you asked me, you know, who did I want to touch? Who did I want to talk to? Who did I want to make a kind of a dent in their perspective? And really it's everybody. There's a little fruit on this tree for everybody to swallow. And for the guys that are headed down that path, you know, or girls, I mean, it's everybody. When the world forces you to stop and take a look at yourself and self-reflect and do something better in your head, just do it. Just take the time and do it. It'll fix it.
Don't fight it.
Don't fight it, you know, and you'll know it. And so I have a family member that has a son that's a cousin of mine, and that he was another knucklehead. And when I got out and started, you know, making better choices and, you know, being productive and, you know, just being a good person in society, he was reaching out to me, asking me how he should treat his son in there. He wants extra money for clothes or books or, you know, all these. And I said, yes, if you have the means to support, support. If he's asking for things that can help him grow, support it. You know, if you don't have the money, I get it. I understand if there's no support there, but if you have the ability to support, support. If they're asking for growth, some support, resources for their growth, then you got to give it to them. You know, that's the, I was lucky to have that. And there were a lot of people in there. I mean, I still am connected to a lot of people in there now that are out, and they had support. Some of them didn't. So then you go into the, well, I have support. Are you interested in learning this? Here, read this book, you know? So there's a lot of, you know, cross trading, I guess you would say, in there, but.
Okay. So tell me about the day when you were released from prison. Tell me about, like, you get your stuff, you walk out, what happens?
Okay. So leading up to that was pretty intense. So at some point in prison, you just get part of the, get in the groove, right? You have your schedules, you have, you know, you got your routines. Life becomes normal in there, if you can say that. It becomes the new norm.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know what life is outside of prison. So it's so towards the end of that sentence, I started trying to read relevant stuff, like up to date stuff. You know, where am I living at? What's going on in the economy? What's going on?
Really? That's really strategic.
Well, I mean, you need to know, right? No one's pretty much, you know, gives you the power to accomplish goals and stuff. So I started trying to get relevant. And like, first you try to tune it all out, right? You don't want to know what you're missing. You know, you want to stay down here, work on this. Let's get through this time. And then we'll deal with the next, you know, project after that. And so here we are. I'm looking 90 days out, 120 days out. It's getting intense. Like, I'm so excited to get out, you know, and see my family and my friends. And I'm ready, you know. You know, it extremely nerve-wracking. Probably a little more nervous than getting in front of this thing right here, for sure. But so I've got my release package. I've got these new clothes. And that was weird. I haven't worn clothes. Like, what is the style? Let's start with that. I didn't even know what styles to wear. So I was, like, asking people that just came from the streets in, like, is this in style right now?
Oh my gosh.
I'm looking at this Billabong plaid shirt, man. Does this look stupid? You know, and, you know, anyway, so,
you know. Because you went in 2002?
2000, yeah, into one.
And then what year were you?
We're at 2012 now, 2000.
That's a big jump. Okay.
2001 to 2000, almost 2000, yeah. So my mom drives up. She is waiting outside, getting, you know, dressed and put on my clothes, and I got these shoes on, like, whoa, some nice, comfortable shoes and blue jeans, like, haven't worn those in over a decade. And so we start walking out, and I remember there's, like, this last Sally port. So they check your name, they check your DC number, they check all these things, and they make sure that you are who you are and you're fixing to walk out of the gates. And then they get to the last gate, they look at your ID again, they look, you know, there's just last little process, and then the Sally port opens, because there's two gates, right? So it goes like this, and you walk in, and then this one closes, and then this one goes. And so I remember when that second one went, I am walking in on floors that I haven't walked on ever, you know, or in the last 10 years. And I remember getting, like, a light kind of euphoric feeling, like lightheaded. I was disoriented a little bit. My breathing was really hard. I was kind of going through, like, an anxiety attack, I guess you could say. And so I take a step out, and the sun's shining on me, and there's no gates in front of me, no barbed wire, no nothing. It was just woods and cars, and you don't see cars in there either. You're on the other side, you know, you're in the woods, and the only cars you see is, like, the gun trucks that run around the prison. Anyway. So, yeah, here we are. I'm sitting in the car. I'm breathing real heavy. I'm like, oh, my God, what's going on? The car's moving really fast. I'm not used to this. I mean, like, everything is just so new and fast. And the things are coming at me so fast, you know? And so my mom's like, well, what do you want? So I had my friend Raj with me. He showed up on the race date. So it's my mom and Roger and me. And she's like, so what do you want to do? And I was like, I want some hash brown smothered covered chunk, please. I want Waffle House. And so she was like, okay, let's go to Waffle House. And so, you know, as you drive.
Wait, hold on. So you thought about this before, right? Like before you were there with your mom and she asked you that. You had to have thought of that.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, I ran through all sorts of stuff.
Like how long were you thinking about hash browns from Waffle House?
Man, really, since I hadn't had them in 10 years. I mean, it is smothered covered chunk. I mean, who don't like Waffle House, you know? But so, yeah.
So you went to Waffle House.
So I went to Waffle House. And on the way there, you know, I'm already noticing new stuff. Like you know, just life is different. A lot of things happen and change in 10 years. And I remember Waffle House was like the first, like, example that stuck out to me. Like, I got a lot to learn. Before I went to prison, when you go to Waffle House, you unscrewed the Heinz 57 ketchup bottle.
Uh-huh.
And remember? And the old commercial was you hold it and it kind of drips out. And sometimes you pump it, you know.
Right.
And okay, well, now they've changed the lid to that rubber stopper things, the squirter.
Oh, yeah.
The squeezies.
Yeah.
That's new. So I've got these new clothes on. We're sitting in the thing. And I see this kind of squeezy plastic Heinz bottle. And I go to squeeze it a little, you know, I'm trying to get it to come out and it won't come out. My mom's sitting over there, you know, Roger's sitting over here. I got this hash browns in front of me. I just want some ketchup on it. And so I do this. It won't come out. And I turn it around and I look at it. I'm like, man, is there like some peeling inside that I need to peel off? So I look at it and I go to squeeze to see, and it shoots this ketchup up.
God.
And I Superman die. I don't want to ruin my new digs. This is my brand new pair of blue jeans. I ain't first pair ever in 10 years. And I dive bomb out of the, anyway. So that was the first experience I had. Jump will still talk about that. I call him Jump. Roger will still talk about that. The first day Jason realized that there's squeezy ketchup bottles.
And Facebook wasn't even that big. You didn't know about Facebook.
Facebook didn't exist. Yeah. So there's a lot of things. Google, smartphones. So when I went in, they had the StarTech Motorola phone that flipped and it did.
Oh, yeah.
It was going from analog to digital. That was my last phone I have. Still have it at my mom's house somewhere in a shoebox. And now that you have these phones that pretty much you do everything on, man. You know, my success today is directly related to Google.
Right.
I mean, like it's a map work of whatever you need, you know,
because you could anything that you were curious about, like, oh, what's that? Or how does that work? Or how do I do this? You just could look it up on Google.
Right.
And figure it out.
How
to, and then fill in the blank.
It was a speech to a program. I wrote a speech to, you know, so there's programs about life's unmanageable, right? For, you know, people revert to drugs and alcohol and all this. And I wrote a speech all about Google. Like, y'all don't tell me that your life's unmanageable and you don't know which way to go. All you got to do is Google. Like, where do I want to eat? Where do I want to sleep? What do I want to learn? YouTube this. I mean, like, wherever. There's a resource out there to
there's
help
resources.
You get through whatever you could possibly be going through.
Hey, Curiositors, just a quick pause to show gratitude to our sponsors and give you some special deals. My husband and I have been using Liquid IV since 2019. We love that you put it in cold water and it actually dissolves and, you know, tastes awesome. Lately, strawberry lemonade flavor has been my go-to. They also have sugar-free now. And in just one stick, I get 5 essential vitamins and hydrated 2 times faster than water alone. Get 20% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use code CURIOUS at checkout. That's 20% off anything you order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code CURIOUS at liquidiv.com. If you love true crime but hate the shows that leave you hanging, you're going to love the show What Was That Like, hosted by Scott Johnson. He interviews ordinary people with extraordinary stories, like people who survived a mass shooting, found an abandoned baby, or got deals on Shark Tank. Every guest is carefully vetted, and many of the stories have an unexpected insight or inspiration. As you know, I'm not a true crime fan, but I love What Was That Like because it's the victims themselves sharing their stories, and I also love the way that Scott holds space in such a respectful way. In fact, I love the show so much that I accepted an invitation to be a co-host on the weekly Tuesday segment. Find What Was That Like anywhere you listen to podcasts, and let me know what you think. Spring has sprung, but so have the mosquitoes, and that can be a real buzzkill. See what I did there? I've been using Insect's mosquito service since 2019, and they continue to impress me. They guarantee their work, and pollinators are always top of mind. Don't wait till the last minute to get on their schedule. If you're in the Florida Panhandle or the Gulf Coast of Alabama, give Insect a call, ensec.net. The Florida Panhandle isn't just the home of your favorite podcaster. That's me, by the way. Shameless, I know. But it's also a go-to spot for a lot of families on vacation. Don't plan a Pensacola trip without getting tickets to the UWF Historic Trust. It's good for a whole week, and it's a great indoor activity option. You'll recognize Trader John's, where I record the show, in the Pensacola Museum of History. Get your tickets in person so you can show the agent one of my emails and get $2 off an adult ticket. HistoricPensacola.org. Now back to the show. Remember to stay till the end, where I give you a sneak peek of next week's episode.
Tell me about, as you come out of prison, they don't just like have a nice life. You have rules you have to follow. Don't you have like fines you have to pay?
Yep.
And
yep.
Tell us, walk us through like the rules.
Well,
it
depends on your charges. Some people go out and they don't have any probation. There's not a lot of restrictions to them. They did their time and that was it. But then for the majority in the state of Florida, that is, you know, is you go through a transition period. You let them know where you're staying at. You have to check in once a week for X amount of time. You have to pay $50 a month for, you know, or whatever your fines are. There's, you know, monetary repetitiously coming through as you're getting back into the world.
What would the fines be for?
Sometimes they were court costs. Maybe you had restitution. Maybe your DUI hit a car, and that car, the insurance claims or the deductibles or whatnot. Well, if you're in jail, you can't pay it. So they just tack it on the end of it. So when you get out, you owe the state or whoever, mm-hmm. you know, the money.
So you have to get a job straight away, obviously, to pay the fine.
I mean, yeah, if you want to. Produce in the world, right? You got to get a job.
Right. There's other motives,
right.
Of course. Was employment also one of your rules that you had to get a job by X date?
You have to be looking for a job, yeah. So in probation, you have to at least show effort that you are trying to obtain a job. And it's hard. So I stayed in Alford for a little bit, and then before I moved to Pensacola. So in Alford, I was there for about 3 months.
What's Alford?
Alford, Florida is a place that I decided I was trying to break the mold here. I didn't want to come back here, get around the same groups, get to doing the same things. And I was unsure of what to expect getting out after a decade. Is anybody holding any bad will, ill will for me still?
Yeah.
I'm on probation. I don't want to have to go, you know, I just don't want anything that could trip me up. And
right.
So I felt like just change places, people and things, and that might be the start of success. So I remember in Alford, man, I went everywhere. I looked for a job everywhere. And do you know, your experience in my education was all prison related. So this correctional facility, I did electrical and brick masonry and PC support. This, I did AutoCAD and everything was prison related. So people look at your resume, you have no work experience for the last decade. And then your education is all prison. So I've got 20 people and this one's going to go over here. And you know, they have all these programs. It's the small print. Nobody even is relevant to this stuff. It sounds good on paper. The politicians say all these things that, well, we have, you know, we offer these programs and these funnels of money and these guarantees and these insured, we bond them. And that doesn't mean anything to anybody. You know, like they say, well, you know, we're trying to help them rehabilitate themselves. But then all the things that they offer, all the programs, goes right over the business owner or the manager's head. They don't care to, you know, why take a chance with this guy?
So when you say they offer these things, you're talking about the programs in prison that you took, and the legislators are saying, well, this is why, you know, everyone, there won't be lower recidivism because they have these. But you're saying, what's the use if the employers
don't hire you anyway?
Then
right.
It's like you have this knowledge, but no way to monetize it.
Right. Yep. And so then they bond it. They say, hey, we'll insure $500,000 for this person. If you give them a job and they last 6 months, or in the first 6 months, we'll insure any damages that they could do. We'll insure your company for it. That's what the government says. I don't remember the number, but there's all sorts of programs out there that try to protect the business owner from giving somebody a second chance shot. And again, it falls by the wayside.
The recidivism rate in Florida is 33%, I found out.
Was it 33%?
33. So one in every three prisoners goes back, and that's in the first 3 years. But then interesting, after 5 years, it jumps to 65%. And I, as I read that, I was thinking about your situation that you went through of what you're talking about, how the challenges of finding employment. I almost wonder if the repeat of after 5 years being a double spike is because you just hit a wall and then you're like, oh, forget this. I'm just going to go back to selling.
Doing what I do.
Yeah, right. Because then that's quick money and I don't have to be hungry and, you know.
I mean, yeah, those are interesting. First of all, the numbers are blow my mind. You know, like you have a statistic that says there's a high probability you're coming back to prison. And then we don't institute anything or it's kind of slightly we institute some things to try to correct that, you know.
Well, when people make policies that don't have personal connections to the people affected by those policies,
right,
they don't really work.
Right.
So just in the interest of time, I want to skip forward to Old Habits Die Hard.
Right.
So in prison, you developed, as Liam Neeson would say, a very specific set of skills to survive in there and to create that new normal of what prison life was. Did you realize that you had held on to some of those habits when you got out?
Oh, yeah. For the most part, I feel like I'm in a good groove now. You know, like I'm trusting. I mean, it's taken eight years now to even want to talk about this.
That's
is a
true.
Big deal, you know. And for the longest time, I don't mind telling my story to an individual, but I want them to know me first.
You know,
hey, how you doing? My name's Jason and I'm an ex-convict. And that kind of scares people away, you know, like, oh, shit, you know, where is he from? And, you know, what did he do? But the mold is hard to break. It you sounds make you look, you know, certain word phrases that people say out here and there, it's a different connotation. So you respond differently, but out here it's just a way of somebody saying hello, but in there that's not the way they say hello. That's
like
a
what?
Way to, well, I mean, I don't know anything specific, just how you doing?
Yeah.
Right. Out here is construed a little differently than how you doing in there, right? You're on guard in jail.
Yeah.
You're always on guard. Everybody's your enemy until you know that they're not your enemy, you know?
Right.
And then so now here you are, Meredith coming up to me, hey, Jay. And like, there's this barrier that I've created in life. Don't get close to me. Don't touch me. Don't, you know, and now I have to break through that and say, no, it's okay to hug your family members or your friends. And, you know, it's okay to be vulnerable to men out in the world, you know, like
right.
Tell my story to somebody and be vulnerable. That's hard. You're not vulnerable in prison, but
that explains when I first met you. Do you remember it was at your grandmother's house?
Uh-oh.
And going in?
It's Garrett, a long way to go, but go ahead.
Yeah, Garrett said, all right, you're going to meet Jason. Prepping me. And we came in and I met you, but you like didn't really give me eye contact. I think you shook my hand. But then what I really did notice is when we were all hanging out in the living room, you were quote unquote asleep in the armchair. And I was like, that fool ain't asleep. He is waiting to see what I will say when I think he's not listening. I felt like you were like checking me out to make sure I was good enough for your cousin. And maybe you were.
Yeah. I can't remember that. I don't remember. So long ago. There's been so many roads to that.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
So yeah, I finally found a job, you know,
okay.
I finally found a job and, you know, I had this saying with my buddy and tried to minimize my cousin here, but I got to say it like this. So I told him that, you know, if a business owner knew the drive and the focus and the desire for success that I personally have, they would hire me. I will shovel shit barefooted up to my knees if you just give me a paycheck. Like I was legit, like there's no way. I even told a guy, and this is how I got my first like real job out here. I told a guy at Subway that I would work for him for free. I was like, man, I can run this place. I used to run one of these. I'll work for free for you today And if you don't, if you like what you see, then hire me. And if you don't like what you see, well, I'll get to stepping. But I think you're going to find I'm a hard worker, you know. And he did. He didn't make me work for free, but he did give me a job and gave me an opportunity. But I gave the same speech to this guy. You know, naturally, I was looking for something better than Subway. You know, minimum wage is just not a way to, you know, get anywhere. So I wanted something better. I wanted to trade. I wanted to get into the industry that I'm in now. And I did the same thing. I said, hey, I'll work for free. If you don't like what you got, I mean, I'm worth $15 an hour, okay? And so that's how it started. I swept warehouse floors and built filtration systems, you know, and just stayed committed. And this is kind of the story that I want to tell everybody, you know, like, you know when someone's not up to good, when they're up to no good. You can see it, right? You can tell by the way that they talk to you or about others, right? The way that they handle just interactions with people. Do they open a door or do they hold the door open, right? That tells you how selfish or unselfish they are, you know? And family members know their family better than anybody else, right? You've seen the raw uncut of me, you know? And so you can tell when I'm doing good. And I think we made talk about this earlier, seeing my friends now, like on Facebook, and I see a lot of people doing really good. And then there's these friends that I see that they're, you know, they say, you know, I'm trying to do this and I'm getting better at this and I'm doing all these things. But I'm seeing all the indicators that you're not, you're trying to sell that to people, but you're really not. And my message when I originally sought out for all of this was, man, it was emotional for me, you know, like it really was emotional for me. I was scared to death going through prison, not saying that I didn't deserve to go there, but it still didn't change the fear, you know. And then I get through it and now I'm scared to death that I'm going to fail. Like I feel like I've prepared myself and the best I could. I mean, I only had what I had. I had the resources available to me at that time in prison and this is all I had, you know, and I gave it everything that I had. And so here I am on the street and somebody finally gives me a chance, you know? So man, I'm sweeping that floor extra good. I'm building this stuff extra well, you know? I am trying to be proactive with the new thoughts, you know? I remember when I finally won my first boss over. He says, hey, and this is when I also learned Google's a great thing. He says, hey, Jay, I need you to get me a quote together and fix these ballast. Now, up until this point, anything that he asked me, and this still is true today, anytime that anybody asks me something, I can do it. I might not even know what you're talking about. By the minute I turn around, I'm going to Google it. I'm going to figure it out and I'm going to learn it because it can be learned.
Right.
If there is, you know, anyway. So I remember he says, oh, I need you to take a quote and build this ballast and, you know, whatnot. And I'm like, okay. He's like, can you handle that? And I'm like, yes, sir. I was yes, man. There was not one thing that this guy was ever going to ask me that I said, oh, I don't know how I'm doing. I am going to be your asset, you know? And so I'm like, yes, sir, I can do that. And I turn around. I'm going, what the heck is a ballast? I'm thinking, does he have a sailboat at his house? You know, like he wants me to work on a sailboat, whatever. I mean, like, he just pay me a paycheck. Like I said, man, just shovel it over the shoulder, you know? And so I Google around on ballast. I'm like, oh, the things in the neon lights. Hi. So realized, so naturally, my stepdad is an electrician. So called him real quick and asked him some, you know, quick questions, relevant questions. And I sought out to do it. And so by the time my boss came back, he's like, hey, did you get that quote together? And I was like, no, I already, you know, I put them on the count, kept it under this amount of money and they're changed. Everything's fixed. And he's like, really? You know, and at that point, he finally was like, nah, your brain's better than sweeping floors in a warehouse.
Nice.
And then the trajectory went from there. And
so tell me what your business is today. Because
it was a company specializing in ice machines. And so that's what we set out to do. Me and my business partner decided that we wanted to build, you know, an employee and customer first approach. And so we didn't really like... We disagreed with some things on how, you know, business
was. You wanted to do your own way.
I wanted to do it a different way. I wanted to give the customers something a little bit better. I wanted to treat the employees just a little bit better, you know. Not that it was wrong then, just that I wanted to do a better job, you know.
Yeah.
And so there's so many thoughts going on right there. I kind of
lost
it.
So you ended up buying the business, right?
Nope.
You took over it?
Nope. No, we just went out on our own. So we had some opportunity. We had a rare opportunity to kind of start and develop the Southeast region for just ice machine maintenance. And it's what we specialized in. He sold, I worked out in the field. It just, I felt right. And I didn't think that there was an opportunity like this that would ever come to me in this fashion again. And, you know, my wife does her own thing, and we were just in a good spot where I could take a chance, you know, and I felt like I deserved it. At this point, I put 5 years of road work, field work, you know, I learned every part of the business that I possibly could. I understood that this could be a good thing. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to take the ticket and I'm checking out, you know. And it's been really well since then. We've diversified into more services now, which is kind of hard when you don't know what you're doing. And then you're saying, yep, I can offer this. There's a whole new learning curve to that, but it's exciting. We're trying to build something good for everybody around us. It's more about the team. It's about the family, you know. Mm-hmm. I was telling them earlier that the challenges are bringing someone new in and you not know them. And it's like, do you follow our culture? Mm-hmm. Is your heart in the right spot? You know, are you in this for the right reasons? You know, and so those are challenging. But
so if you wanted to share some advice perspective to three different groups, and one of them was people who are in prison now, what do you want to say to people who are, that's where they're at right now?
If I could talk to them, this is what I would say. But, you know, upon their release, I would love to have the message to them that if you, you know, while you're in there, stay focused naturally to be a better person, to figure you out. This is a time to figure yourself out. There's nothing else to do. Why not understand your strengths and weaknesses? Why not help yourself operate better on just honesty, you know, like be honest to the world and to yourself, and then be the best version of yourself, you know? And then the family members that support them, right? So you work on you, and the family members, stay supportive of them. Offer them some resources. Give them a lifeline that gives them hope and perspective. Because when you feel lost and nobody's like looking at you, you know, it's really hard to like, you know, my main goal was to get out and make my mom proud. My mom has been through so much because of me, and she was the only one that like really, I mean, Grandma Jean too, but those two women really remained very, very faithful to Jason finally finding his way. I mean, I put them through so much stuff. It's ridiculous. And today I can hold my head high, you know, like my mom is a grandma now to my children, and she's proud of those kids, you know? So the family, it's instrumental. Don't lose faith of your family. They'll find their way. And you know what? Even if they don't, let's just say 60 years go by and they're doing the same old thing and you've supported them the same old way. I'm not saying open up your bank account and give them free rein to your stuff. But if there are good things to support them on, then support them. And even 60 years go by and they never learn, it's still, you're not a failure there. You're just a person with love and adoration for your family, and you maintain faith to give them a better opportunity, you know, and it's important. It really is. I couldn't stress that enough for family members out there going through it. And you know, like I said, you know, so you know if it's time to help or not. If right. somebody's talking in a way that says they ain't working on their self, mm-hmm. then don't offer any up, you know. You
can't, don't enable them.
Don't enable them, right. But if they're like talking good stuff and you know they're talking positive stuff, then you gotta support them. That might be the one opportunity and chance that you do have to help them get over the hump and be happy and successful. And
what about if you were going to talk to some
so the
people
naysayers.
In charge? Or, yeah, naysayers.
The naysayers, right? So there's a stigma out here, right? And, you know, you go to prison and you're not worth anything anymore, right? There mm-hmm. are people that just don't do it. And I have met, you know, a couple people really close and dear to my heart now. They have changed their perspectives of me, but refused to even want to meet me when they found out that they found out the wrong way. Like I said, I like to meet someone. Hey, how are you doing? This is who I am. Oh, yep. I'm a nice guy. I'm easy to talk to. I'm not a threat. Right.
Right.
And then, oh, by the way, 10 years ago, I did this and I had to go through this. And that's a better opening to people that don't know me. But this person, it was like, nope. Hey, I want you to meet this person. They just got out of prison and, you know, da-da-da. I ain't meeting that person.
Right.
I understand kind of prison was nothing like the movies. I mean, there is a lot of stuff about it that's similar. They do follow a trend, but the people, there's a lot of good people in there that deserve an opportunity. We make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes, you know? And this is the stigma here. So I hear people all the time that try to relate, which is a good way to relate. They try to relate by saying, you know, there's no difference between me and you. The only difference is that you got caught. okay, well, if that is, and I hear that a lot, if that is accurate, then who are you to cast a stone and judge? Because I got caught? Because I was stupid enough to get caught? Or you were smart enough to get away with it, so you're too good for me? And so to the naysayers that, you know, when people that want to do better have a line of resource and they're determined and they have support, then they're going to do good things. Everybody needs support, right? Everybody needs resources. You got schools. You need to learn, you know. So I'm trying to think of the best way to say this now that I'm in front of a microphone.
No, I think you,
there's a message here that
I think I hear the message. And I think it's the whole theme of the Meredith For Real, the Curious Introvert. It's my whole shtick, if you will, is don't assume, explore, find out who that person is as an individual. Just because they have a certain experience doesn't mean you have to put them in a box.
Right.
So, well, that is all we have time for today. But if people want to follow your business or your story, can they find you online?
Yep. We're on social media, Instagram now. I think we just started the Instagram. So it's Oasis Preferred Maintenance.
Okay.
Look us up if you have any refrigeration issues, ice machines. We got a lot of good material out there. So
awesome. Well, that is a wrap. Thank you so much. This was amazing.
Thanks for having me.
Good job.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, you'll also like the one I did with a man Jason met while in prison who accidentally killed two girls in a DUI accident. It's called Eagle Scout to Endmate, and it's episode 37. Stay tuned next week when I talk with a Georgetown political science professor asking the question, should uninformed voters' votes count for less?